content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, a team of volunteer readers will be reading short science fiction stories. We call our program Science Fiction Shorts, and it will be available in podcast after the broadcast.
I'm Sonia Usach-Kuhn, and I'll be reading Masterclass by Cassandra Kaw. Even Jesus had a mother, Mayin smiled, expression reptilian. A thin laugh broke across the group. There were 12 women that evening, all Chinese, although the very tonality of their complexions suggested that some had more complicated ancestries than others. A drip of Javanese blood, a hint of pale-eyed European. Not that it really mattered, Mayin thought as she paced away from the backboard, heels clicking like talons on the linoleum. The instinct to obey a matriarchal figure is built into the human DNA. In that way, sexism has been rather helpful. More laughter. We credit fathers as the fun, indulgent ones. Mothers, on the other hand, are seen as caretakers, nurturers, both the ones who protect and the ones who must be protected. Su Ling, shapeless in her sweater, bony knees drawn under the fabric, raised a slim arm. But aren't fathers the one expected to defend their households? Mei Yin shrugged. Physically, yes, and stereotypically speaking, only ever to a certain extent. Yes, they're expected to throw themselves into the face of danger, but mothers are meant to do so. They're expected to embrace it. Mothers, and she grinned as she said the word, teeth dragging over the sibilants, are the ones who lift cars, the ones who dive into burning buildings, the ones who endure grotesque bodily harm. Note the choice of words. Fathers are permitted to consider personal risk. Mothers are not. I don't see a point in this conversation, a bored voice from the third row. The point is that we're built of previous conditions. We are conditioned to pause when a mother speaks. We are conditioned to flinch from contact with hot surfaces. We are conditioned to retreat at the sight of a predator. Someone huffed. Not all of us. No. Under the glare of white fluorescent lights, Mayin's eyes were gold, not brown, and her teeth were unusually sharp. Good women filed their dentition down, but Mayin didn't subscribe to such idiocy. It was a waste of one's natural gifts. Which brings me to my next topic. She extracted a cigarette, black, with the tiniest banding of gold around its middle, from a pocket and held it to her lips. Mayin breathed out. Flame plumed from between her lips. The dragon lady trope is one we're all familiar with. Although applicable to women of any age, it is most commonly associated with those in the late 20s and above. It is a term intended to derail from the power we accrete across the course of our lives, hard won from those early years of suffering. It is meant to debase, to minimize. A dragon lady is not a human woman, but an animal that exists out of polite categorization. Another ripple of laughter, this time rueful. Well, Mei Yin sighed. Fuck that. Today's ladies, we shall examine the intersection between mothers and dragons, the places where the two meet, and how best to bring out the qualities of both worlds. A hand shot up from the back. Will you teach us magic today? I'll do you one better, Mei Yin, her shadow serpentine on the wall and her ribs incandescent beneath their sheath of white cotton, grinned wide. I'll teach you fire.
This is Joe Campo, Between the Lines by Wendy Nickel. We met in the pages of a book, somewhere shortly before Act Two. It wasn't my story. It wasn't his. We weren't even secondary characters. Not the best friend or the sidekick, and certainly not the villain. But we were there, on the edges, behind the lines, between the letters. Insignificant, yes, but there. We were somewhere just off page, like actors waiting in the wings. When our elbows brushed and we found one another, without the slightest blush or fanfare. You aren't a rival love interest, I asked in whispers. Not the jealous ex. No, I'm not. Are you? Not that I know of. At least not in this volume. Good. I'm glad. And he smiled. Our fingers brushed, touched, entwined, and from that moment on we were inseparable. We kept to ourselves, sneaking off when we weren't needed, to frolic in the margins of previously read chapters and huddle, knees touching in the spine. How do you think it'll end? He asked as we eavesdropped on their conversations as their story rose and fell. I don't know, I said. I never did like endings. And with theirs would come our own. It came too soon, as I worried it would, full of tears and tragedy and the final plot twist that made everything make sense. Everything, that is, but us. Do you think there'll be a sequel? He gripped my hand. If there is, I'll see you there. We kissed. Just once. And the final page turned.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and I'll be reading Astronauts Can't Touch You by Carly St. George. Your whole world is the hospital room. Everything else is light years away. New York City, for instance. Sometimes it moves closer, sometimes further. On 9/11, it was in your backyard. But today it's Pluto, an inconceivable distance of darkness and dying stars. Who cares that aliens have landed? Are turning skyscrapers into confetti. Who cares if the city's on fire? Nothing on Pluto can touch you. Everyone outside this room is an astronaut, and you're never surprised when astronauts die. They allow you to sit with the body for as long as you want. The nurses are distracted, frightened. New York City isn't Pluto, not to them. But then it's not San Francisco, either. There are so many cornfields standing between them and destruction. So much time for a counter-defense. There is always hope for rescue, and in the meantime, they have a job to do. You're allowed to sit with the body. While you do, the nurses wait. You were curled sideways in a blue recliner, when your father went and left his body behind. You think you were dreaming about footprints. When you woke, his hand was already cool. Did he wake before he left you? Did he try to say something, to reach out? He had stared through you the night before, murmuring alien tongues you couldn't decipher. But maybe you were the alien to him. Maybe his whole world was even smaller than yours, the length and width of his hospital bed. Maybe you were the astronaut on Pluto, and he was waving you goodbye. sure even then that you were the one leaving. At a certain point, you just can't bear to stay in a world where you're the sole survivor. Peter is only an astronaut outside the hospital room. Once he walks in and takes off his space helmet, once he wiggles his stethoscope out from under his bulky white suit, he's only a nurse again, tangible, someone you can touch. Peter gives you a hug without prompting and talks a little more about energy than you'd like, about molecules and space dust, about the death and return of things. He's trying to be helpful, you know. You're sure everyone will fail at being helpful the next few days. The hospital provided you with a comfort basket upon signing a POLST form for your father's care. The basket comes with tea and water and grief literature. It does not, apparently, come with a spacesuit for your own use. You think you'll die when you open the door and leave your father's body behind, but the oxygen stays stubbornly in your lungs as you float through the hospital corridor in zero-G. You try not to think in specifics. You try not to imagine the nurses doing their work, struggling to lift the body, zipping it inside the bag, preparing him for launch. Outside, there are astronauts everywhere. There is an astronaut in a wheelchair waiting for her ride. There is an astronaut across the street holding a vanilla ice cream cone. An astronaut impatiently waits for a parking spot while another sits in his car, texting secret astronaut messages. You nearly float into a woman who's watching the news, holding her phone so close to her helmet that it's actually touching the glass. "God," she says, looking up at you. "Aliens. I mean, aliens. Can you believe it?" Her voice is a little flat, so she probably can't believe it herself. Maybe that's why she's left a trail of dusty red boot prints across the asphalt behind her. If New York is Pluto and you're in California, is she somewhere on Mars? You don't know. You don't know how to define your world anymore. "My dad's dead," you don't say. "My dad's dead!" "I can believe it," you say, and float past her. By comparison, aliens aren't so hard to accept. Lewis is not an astronaut. That's important, but you're not sure why. He's angry that you drove home by yourself, but he doesn't yell at you because it takes a special kind of asshole to yell at someone whose father just died. He's hurt, though. He wanted to be at the hospital, doesn't understand why you sent him away. He's apparently spent the last 12 hours cooking. You won't eat any of his 7 casseroles. You watch the news together. Improbably, a ragtag team of unlikely heroes has blown up the mothership. Lewis says, "Thank God. Oh, thank God it's all going to be okay." Maybe you scream then. You're not sure. You can't breathe for a while, and things get blurry and dark. But you do remember how he keeps trying to hug you and how you keep pushing him away because you can't touch his skin without feeling a layer of thin cloth between you. He can't see it, but you know what it is. The body bag he'll be in someday, when he eventually commands his own space mission. Crew of One, Destination Nowhere. He can't see it, but it's all you can see. "I'm right here," he keeps saying. "I'm right here." But he won't be. He won't. Later that night, you can't sleep. You extricate yourself from Lewis's arms and check the news on your computer. The death toll in New York is already in the tens of thousands. Every 15 minutes it goes up, body bag after body bag. But still, it means nothing to you. The whole planet could be littered with dead astronauts and it wouldn't mean anything at all, because you can't touch them and they can't touch you. You can't touch them. They can't touch you. By the time Lewis wakes up, you've almost finished making the spacesuit. There's a crack in the faceplate, but you cover it with duct tape. The helmet fits snugly over your hair. You wish you could make Lewis an astronaut, but he's Lewis. He wears ties with cartoon characters on them and cooks when he's anxious and once made you not only a house but an entire gingerbread kingdom just to make you laugh. You'd never be able to banish him to another world. He could never be so far away. And yet, it hurts. It hurts to touch his skin. It hurts to remember one of you has to launch first. Lewis tries to kiss you, but there's glass in the way. "This isn't healthy," he says. "Please don't shut me out." But you need this right now. You need this to keep moving, one lumbering step in front of the other. And isn't that what all the comfort basket pamphlets said? That there's no wrong way to do this? There's no wrong way to grieve? "My dad's dead," you say. It's the first time you've been able to say it out loud. "I can't lose him. I can't. And he's dead." Lewis puts his arms around your spacesuit. You can only just barely feel his touch. And Christ, you're grateful. You're so fucking grateful for that. "You won't lose me," Lewis says. And it's a lie. You know it is. But floating there, safe in your spacesuit on the other side of the universe from all the dead, you can almost make yourself believe it. You can almost pretend there's hope for rescue, after all.
This is Steve Lord reading Fine Dining During the Apocalypse by James Van Pelt. Spices and creative thinking in the kitchen offer the diner looking for the best culinary experience no reason to despair in these new and challenging times. The stores have long ago been sacked, of course, shelves cleared and many burned to the ground. But they were obvious targets. You won't discover the ingredients you need there, and certainly not the main courses. The last time I found anything useful in a store was last year, and it was a box of oatmeal that had been kicked under a counter. Mice had been at it, but what remained, cooked with a pinch of wild peppermint leaves, bruised but not shredded, and topped with 3 poached robin eggs, smelled delicious, and has lingered in my taste bud's memory since. A selection of spices is the secret to preparing the sort of meals your less fastidious neighbors will covet. Most houses have been looted, and some are occupied. Always announce your intentions before entering a new site. But you are much more likely to claim a prize since the early scavengers sought canned foods and were likely to overlook a delicacy like thyme or saffron. Just this week, I added a nearly full bottle of cumin, a small box of tartar, some basil, and the real treasure, an unopened 16-ounce bottle of cinnamon powder. My stash includes several pounds of salt, a sugar barrel, a half case of light virgin olive oil, a selection of liquors, as accompaniment, of course, and a variety of the more common spices, like bay leaf, garlic powder, cayenne pepper, nutmeg, and oregano, most found in empty homes. Remember my oatmeal and robin egg creation? Sadly enough, I realized that my exotic spices will not last forever. So the far-sighted Epicurean will also familiarize himself with the native edibles. Within a few miles of my kitchen, I have found the aforementioned peppermint, along with yarrow, sagebrush, bergamot, and Mormon tea. A multitude of wild fruit is also available to add to your menu when in season. Elderberries? These must be cooked. They are toxic when raw. Oregon grape and holly grape. Pin cherries? Use sparingly as they are sour. Raspberries, thimbleberries, and strawberries. Be sure to familiarize yourself with baneberries, though. They are exceptionally lethal. Indians use them to poison their arrows. Some flowers, bushes, and trees are edible, or have edible parts. I'm working on a longer article for these. If you are willing to experiment, limit yourself to tiny samples. Although much in the world delights, much is deadly, or at least will make you feel like you want to die. If your tongue tingles, burns, or you experience symptoms other than the pleasant treat of a new taste, remember what it was and don't eat it again. All the spices in the world won't matter if you can't find a main dish. Of the few people I've met since the world fell apart, most live off canned foods while hoping that their experiments in agriculture will pay off later. They have my best wishes, and I look forward to trading with them if they succeed. But for the diner longing for a diet with flavor and zesty ingredients, especially fresh meat, there are numerous opportunities beyond setting off to hunt deer or elk, or waiting until hastily planted vegetables can be harvested. Surely we can do better than scraping baked beans or creamed corn from cans. For the brave connoisseur, rats are plentiful in urban areas, as are mice. But mice are more difficult to prepare. Still, with patience and time, a mouse meat quiche makes a worthy mid-morning meal. My experiment with a mice pie was less successful. Rat, squirrel, possum, marmot, and prairie dog have much to offer, and the subtle differences in taste and texture offer the bold chef a multitude of repasts. On the avian side, pheasant, duck, and turkey make excellent bases for meals that a king would envy, but it would be a mistake to miss the potential delights of starling, pigeon, or crow. Insects, too, add unexpected possibilities. A cup of grasshoppers and ants, finely minced and then sautéed with a pinch of salt and a tablespoon of lemon juice, turns into a fine pâté, suitable for a cracker spread. For myself, my kitchen is entirely wood-fire powered. This limits cooking time to the night when smoke won't call attention to my efforts, but that provides the advantage of the day for foraging, preparing the ingredients, or marinating. Although the inconvenience of the occasional unreasonable survivor is not inconsiderable, a more immediate impediment has been roving dog packs. They are smart and tenacious, but have provided an unexpected boon. The palate-delighting delicacy of the new age, I predict, will be dog meat. Surprisingly tasty and easy to obtain, dog makes one forget the comparably pale pleasures afforded by beef. The meat is dark red, finely marbled, and strongly flavored. A 30-pound animal provides several exciting meals, and properly seasoned and smoked makes an excellent jerky. So, imagine my typical day. I rise at dawn to a breakfast of soft-boiled bird's eggs and wild greens. Spend an hour breaking wood from the fallen houses in the neighborhood into suitable lengths for the stove. Then I visit my traps to see what will be added to the larder. The afternoon is devoted to scavenging while contemplating what recipe will be consumed that evening. As the sun sets, the ingredients come out of the cabinets. Whatever meat will be the main course awaits preparation. And finally, when darkness has fallen, the meal is assembled and put in the oven or atop the stove. Gradually, cooking smells fill the kitchen. Sauces bubble in their pots. Meat sizzles, and the basting is carefully performed with ritualistic precision. Spices' heady aromas tease the appetite until finally all finishes and is assembled on the plate. Presentation takes center stage. A deglazed sauce dripped across the artfully arranged meat, and a parsley sprig to accentuate the delicacy pairs well with a full-bodied Pinot Noir or a Bordeaux Merlot. Only the best silverware will do. My table is set on the porch. I situate myself comfortably. Below my house on the hill, the old neighborhood spreads out, catching the moonlight in shadowy blue and black, illuminating the collapsed frames, the burned-out hulks and broken cars. I raise the first bite to my lips, anticipating the rush of flavors, the complex mix of spice and heat, texture and flavor that only a well-prepared meal can offer. Civilization's best achievement. Such a treat. I pause, holding off for a moment that first heady bite. In the distance, tomorrow's dinner barks at the night. With joy, I eat.
You've been listening to Science Fiction Shorts on North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Kurt Benrood. My team of volunteer readers and I thank you for listening in, and we would love to have you join us next time. And just a quick reminder, this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, and it is available in podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Once again, that's www.ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If you are a fan of science fiction and have something to say, we want to hear from you. Live long and prosper.